This meeting is recorded so that an audio version can be posted to the website in the future. So let's begin with a moment of silence, followed by the ACA Serenity Prayer. Love, grant me the serenity to accept the people I cannot change, the courage to change the one I can, and the wisdom to know that one is me. This meeting features three speakers who will share their personal experience, strength, and hope. Each will speak for about 15 to 20 minutes. There will be a 5-minute gentleness break in between speakers. If you're new to ACA, there will be a 15-minute period after the meeting. If you'll stick around to ask any questions you have about the program or connect with other ACAs. A word about safety during this meeting. For anyone choosing to keep their video on during the meeting, please be mindful of your surroundings. If your device's camera can see it, everyone here can see it. Also, please be mindful of using the speaker function on your device. We want to maintain anonymity for our speakers. During the speaker portions of this meeting, the chat function will be disabled for safety and serenity. At times when the chat is enabled, like now, if you receive an inappropriate chat message, we ask that you send a message to one of the co-hosts. And I think I am actually the only co-host, so please send a message to me. What you hear at this meeting should remain at this meeting. We do not talk about another person's story or experience to other people. Please respect the anonymity of those who will share here today. Thank you. Okay, so we've got some volunteers. Lonnie, would you please read the ACA 12 steps? And I am going to share it on the screen, if you'd like to use that.
Mute. All right. Good afternoon. I'm Lonnie. Wait, Lonnie. Let me just shrink it up a little bit. Sorry, y'all, it's so small, but it's okay. I'll get through it. We admitted we were powerless over the effects of alcoholism and family dysfunction, that our lives had become unmanageable. 2, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. 3, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood God. 4, made a searching and fearless inventory of ourselves. 5, admitted to God. Wait a minute, it's gone up. Admitted to God. Wait. I'm sorry. Admitted to God, to ourselves. And I'm sorry. And another human being. The exact nature of our wrong. 6, we're entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. 7, humbly ask God to remove our shortcomings. 8, made a list of all persons we had harmed, became willing to make amends to them all. 7, 8, I'm sorry, I'm just confused here. 9, made direct amends to such people whenever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. 10, continued to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. 11, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understand God, praying only for the knowledge of God's will for us and the power to carry that out. And having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we try to carry this message to others who still suffer, and to practice these principles in all of our affairs. Thank you for letting me read.
Thank you, Lonnie. Alexandra, please read the 12 traditions for us. I'm gonna put those on the screen.
Hi, Alexandra Dalchild. 1, our common welfare should come first. Personal recovery depends on ACA unity. 2. For our group purpose, there is but one ultimate authority, a loving God as expressed in our group conscience. Our leaders are but trusted servants. They do not govern. 3. The only requirement for membership in ACA is a desire to recover from the effects of growing up in an alcoholic or otherwise dysfunctional family. 4. Each group is autonomous, except in matters affecting other groups or ACA as a whole. We cooperate with all other 12-step programs. 5. Each group has but one primary purpose, to carry its message to the adult child who still suffers. 6. An ACA group ought never endorse, finance, or lend the ACA name to any related facility or outside enterprise, lest problems of money, property, and prestige divert us from our primary purpose. 7. Every ACA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. 8. Adult children of alcoholics should remain forever non-professional, but our service centers may employ special workers. 9. ACA as such ought never be organized, but we may create service boards or committees directly responsible to those they serve. 10. Adult children of alcoholics has no opinion on outside issues. Hence, the ACA name ought never be drawn into public controversy. 11. Our public relations policy is based on attraction rather than promotion. We maintain personal anonymity at the level of press, radio, TV, films, and other public media. 12. Anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all our traditions, ever reminding us to place principles before personalities. Thank you.
Thank you, Alexandra. In ACA, we meet to share the experiences we had as children growing up in an alcoholic or dysfunctional home. That experience infected us then, and it affects us today. By practicing the 12 steps and attending meetings regularly, we find freedom from the effects of alcoholism or other family dysfunction. As ACA members, we identify with the laundry list traits. We learn to live in the solution of reparenting ourselves one day at a time. Okay, now I am going to mute everyone except for our speakers, our speaker at the time. I'm grateful to introduce our first speaker, Julianne. So Julianne,
hi.
Welcome.
Thank you for inviting me to speak here today, Sharon. My name is Julianne, and I am a recovering adult child. This was harder for me to put together than I thought it would be. I've discovered I still have some really deep anger and sadness about this issue. So let me share with you what it's been like for me to be an atheist in recovery. I was raised in a double alcoholic household filled with the ghostly remnants of generational dysfunction. I grew up on military bases where the culture revolved almost entirely around alcohol. When I turned 13, my birthday present was a bottle of Boone's Farm Strawberry Hill with a custom-made label calling it Super Kool-Aid. Drinking was a lifestyle. I remember once when I was about 14, a group of drunks shouting instructions to me. It was midnight. They were teaching me how to sail a small sailboat. It was pitch black. I felt terrified, and they were oblivious. The details aren't as important as explaining that I learned early in my life that performance was more important than content, and that keeping the alcoholics in my life happy was safer than attempting to be my own person. When I did try to express my personal autonomy, I was thrown out of the house by my father. Regardless of outside temperature, the way I was dressed, time of day, it was, needless to say, a chaotic and insecure environment, and one with which I'm sure we're all familiar. In 1985, when I was 24, my mom came to me and said, "I think you're an alcoholic." and I was such a good codependent, I started going to AA, and she went to Al-Anon. I had been drinking a lot, and my behavior was erratic, but I didn't think I was an alcoholic. However, I knew something was wrong. I wasn't happy. I couldn't maintain relationships with other people. I had explosive anger issues, and I was living a fear-based life. I was constantly anxious, and I didn't know why. Now, years later, she'll have 36 years sobriety in February, and my father died almost 6 years ago of the disease. I've seen both sides of alcoholism, long-term recovery, and death. My personal recovery journey started in AA, moved through Al-Anon, Overeaters Anonymous, CODA, ACOA, back to Al-Anon, and now back to ACA. It took me years to understand that I'm not the alcoholic in the family. I'm the codependent adult child. In all the time I've been in 12-step recovery, I've never heard anyone in the rooms say, you can't find recovery if you're Black, Asian, gay, lesbian, mentally ill, old, disabled, young, poor, rich, white, purple, dye your hair, have piercings, tattoos. What I have heard is you cannot recover if you don't have God. I'm an atheist. I came into the rooms of recovery to find a way to heal. I hated myself. I had no self-esteem. I was depressed. I was suicidal. I was needy. I was desperate for acceptance. And I was forgiven my suicidal ideations, my emotional outbursts, my needy grasping for connection. What couldn't be forgiven was my lack of belief in God. If you hear nothing I say today, please hear this. It is hard enough to walk into these rooms. Can we stop shaming people for being and behaving differently? I've been shamed more for being an atheist than anything else in recovery. And I talk about many things during meetings that make people really uncomfortable. Anything is fair game if it threatens my serenity, my mental illness, my complex PTSD, my physical health, relationship abuse, spirituality, anything. And nothing I talk about gets the reaction that saying I don't believe in God brings. I was raised Jewish. I was subject to anti-Semitism because of that. We had a swastika spray painted on the side of our house once, and Mom wouldn't let me out of the house for days. I found that my religion was an issue for the world. And as I grew older, that Star of David I wore pretty openly, as others wore a cross, marked me as different and open to ridicule. Part of growing up in my house was learning to debate. I had to be able to hold my own with any adult conversations. Had to defend my position. I had to do it logically and with conviction. I took that skill set of arguing with authority figures with me to school. In fourth grade, I argued with my teacher so vehemently when we were studying the universe that she got so frustrated, she turned the classroom over to me and she walked out of the classroom. My father was incredibly proud that I knew more about the subject than my teacher did, and there was never any discussion about my behavior. Eventually, I was sent to Catholic school because it was supposedly the best school in town. And even though I was Jewish, I'd read the New Testament. And after arguing with the nuns one too many times about the fact that they were quoting the New Testament incorrectly, I was invited to never come back to religion class and I got a free study hall. I felt shamed for my stance on religion. I felt separate from the group. I felt different. My parents encouraged my argumentative nature and I was praised for winning arguments regardless of the tactics I used. Winning was the goal. This training has not served me well as an adult. When I first walked into the rooms in 1985, it was a very male-dominated environment. I was one of two females. Coming from a childhood of dysfunction with a major coping mechanism of codependency, my only thought was to please those of you teaching me about recovery. And I was told I had to have God. I was told I had to give up doing things my way. I was told that God, prayer, and meditation would fix everything. Inside of my head, all I could hear was, but you don't understand. And you know, that's the cry of everyone first in recovery. You don't understand. I'm different. And in a way I was, because what I wanted was to maintain my personal spirituality within this spiritual program. And I was told that my version of spirituality was flawed. By the time I came back to program in 2012, I was solid in my atheism. I did try one more time to find God. I went back to synagogue, attended Torah study, prayed the prayers, did service work, and I found social connection. Well, what I didn't find was recovery. I'm getting ahead of myself. Over and over, I complained that recovery felt similar to my family of origin. I argued about that a lot, that being denied my autonomy, my choice of power greater than myself, felt icky. Felt like I was being dictated to. It felt like I was disappointing everyone in the program because I wouldn't just submit and accept that God was the answer to all my problems. It was too reminiscent of living with my father. He didn't believe in mental illness, and he raised a daughter with major depressive disorder and anxiety disorder. My reality was constantly discounted. What I heard growing up was, stop being so lazy. There's nothing wrong with you. Get over yourself. Do as I say. Pull yourself up by your bootstraps. And yeah, I really did hear that one growing up. So I felt discounted in recovery. And the only response I knew was the one that I'd learned in childhood, attempted compliance. I tried to find God. I tried to do what I was told, and it didn't work. Why couldn't I just do recovery right? Eventually, what happened is I stopped going to meetings because the ridicule was too shaming. Eventually, I stopped working my program, and of course, I emotionally relapsed. I reverted to survival behavior, which led to some really poor life choices. 4 marriages to 3 different men pretty much sums up my 20s and my 30s. I was repeating the pattern of my mom, the pattern I was desperate to avoid. I was a failure. My depression got worse, I was miserable, and I became suicidal again. Although I sought outside help, I didn't have that social connection. And I had felt like that path of spiritual healing that had been promised to me had abandoned me. I hated myself more than when I had first walked into the rooms. My religion was wrong as a child, and my personal beliefs were wrong as an adult. Oh, sure, the literature says you can choose a higher power of your understanding, as long as the word you use is God and the pronoun you use is male. God, prayer, and meditation. The steps were suggestions, but that God thing, you had to find that, because without that, you had no chance of recovery. It was worded in such a way that it always sounded like I had a choice, God as we understand him. It's just that there seemed no room for non-believers. I didn't have the word shame in my vocabulary at the time. Today, I know that I was feeling shamed for not submitting to something that was totally against my personal belief. I felt rejected for who I was, and I rejected you because of it. That took time. I hung around the rooms for about 12 years before I walked away. In 2012, I had reached an emotional bottom, and I was ready to acknowledge that the way I was doing things wasn't working, and I was willing to work program again. So here I was, 51 years old, newly divorced, and tired of being miserable. I walked back into the rooms because I knew that the answer to so many issues in my life were there, but I also knew I couldn't do the God thing. So I came back to recovery with the attitude of, screw you, I've had enough, I'm doing it my way. Well, let me tell you, in the rooms of recovery, saying you're going to do it your way leads to a lot of scorn, disbelief, and ridicule. No one really wanted to hear that it was possible to find recovery without God. I always found it interesting, though, that not a single person asked me if I had a power greater than myself, because everyone assumed that I didn't. Everyone seemed focused on that one word, God. It bothered me then, and it continues to bother me today. You read the big red book, and it says, on the one hand, that we're free to choose a higher power of our own understanding, while on the other hand, it claims, and I quote, we are children of God, seeking to reclaim our true nature or original selves. And that's just a single example of the big red book where it's definitive in its stance that not only does God exist, but I must believe in God in order to reclaim my true nature. So I thought, I guess I'm never going to find and heal my inner child if a belief in God's required. During this time, my mom, who's in AA, was working to keep a We Agnostics AA meeting from being delisted. She's incredibly versed in the traditions and the concepts. And I live in the Midwest, where those damn atheists were really making the people in AA uncomfortable. So I spent a lot of time watching her, and I listened and I learned. I learned about the traditions. I learned about the concepts, things that I hadn't done previously in Al-Anon and ACOA. I learned about outside issues and the only requirement for membership and our common welfare. And I learned how to talk about the traditions because just knowing them wasn't enough. And the first thing I did with all this knowledge was call for a group conscience at a meeting that I went to talk about not ending the meeting with the Lord's Prayer. And I was not prepared for the reaction because the consensus was, what's your problem? We've always done it this way. People came up to me afterwards thanking me for bringing up the subject, saying that they'd always wanted to do that. And the only thing I could think of was, why haven't you? From that point on, I was an advocate against outside issues. I probably went too far the other direction. I was probably a little too aggressive, and that was part of my learning process. And I was forgiven for being militant about the traditions. I still wasn't forgiven for being an atheist. So when I was finally so frustrated that I couldn't find a safe place, a welcoming meeting, someone to work the steps with in a secular manner, literature that was welcoming to a free thinker, I went out and created it. 2 years ago, I started an in-person ACA meeting. And since then, I've been yelled at for making it incredibly uncomfortable for people to talk about God in meetings. The irony to me was interesting. What I actually did was remind people that everything after the comma is an outside issue. There was a lady at a meeting that I attended, and I'm not exaggerating. Every time she started her share, she would go, "My higher power, whom I choose to call, is Jesus Christ." I felt really unsafe, and I didn't know how to talk about it. So I called World Service, and this is what I was told. Everything after that comma is an outside issue. My higher power, comma, whom I choose to call. Everything after that comma, outside issue. I wasn't shy about talking about it once I had the language for it, and people were really uncomfortable because they'd always talked about God in meetings. I reminded them that we have no opinion on outside issues, that the only requirement for membership is a desire to recover from the effects of family dysfunction, and that our common welfare should come first. Which means to me, I leave my personal beliefs at the door, and all I talk about in the rooms is recovery from family dysfunction. Everything after that comma is an outside issue. You'd have thought I told them they couldn't believe in God. I was exposed to anger on a level I'd not experienced in years. They yelled during meetings. They told me I was hindering their recovery. They could go to one meeting. They could go to any meeting, okay? They could go to any meeting they wanted, and I only had one meeting where I felt safe. Imagine, I was told that not talking about an outside issue during a meeting was hindering recovery. I had very little sympathy. I'd spent years being shamed, and what I was doing now was working to create a secular recovery space. If you live in a God-centered world, this is uncomfortable. And if you work a spiritual bypass in your program, this is uncomfortable. Anyway, I'd purchased all the ACA literature that I could get my hands on, and as my home group was working through the Yellow Workbook, I almost quit recovery again because I found the narrative so uncomfortable and offensive. Literature is critical to me. For many people, literature is their first introduction to recovery, and I had been so hindered in my recovery by all the God talk, and our literature is dismissive at best and punitive at worst to the non-believer. What was an atheist to do? Well, rewrite the book, of course. So I did. Page by page, line by line, question by question, I studied the writings, crossed out, rewrote, and shared with my group how I was changing the literature. I took the principles of the steps, the underlying core spiritual beliefs, and made sure those shone through while I dumped all the holier-than-thou must-have God shame on you if you don't crap. I'd helped women rewrite the steps before. This wasn't that different. If you have a problem with God or the male pronoun and your personal trauma leaks into those issues, it can be hard to read the literature. Wounds are important. Wounds, words can wound deeply, or they can open up things that you thought were patched up and scabbed over. Over the years, I've had people say to me, "I would never do that. I would never tell someone they couldn't recover if they didn't have God." And you know what? Maybe you wouldn't. I don't know. But here's my question. When someone is offensive in a meeting, do you call it out? When someone says something that's harmful during a meeting, do you call a group conscience vote? Or are you silent? What I know today is that it's easier to talk about race or sex than it is to talk about leaving God out of 12-step rooms. So I'm 60 years old. I was raised Jewish. I came to atheism after a long and torturous journey full of religious exploration. I am not confused. I am not angry at religion. I am not rebellious. Culturally, I'll always be Jewish, and I'm an atheist. But how do you work your program? That's a question I get a lot. And you know, it's really simple. I have a sponsor and a service sponsor, and I in turn sponsor women. I work the steps from a secular perspective. I study the traditions and the concepts, and I practice prayer and meditation. I do. What is prayer? Every prayer I've ever heard is a cry for help. I've learned to reach out to other people in program and tell them that I'm not okay. I've learned to listen to that inner intuition that points out red flags in the road. I used to stomp those red flags into the ground and grind them under the weight of my self-will. Nowadays, I pause. I don't always stop my forward motion, but I've learned to slow down. Prayer for me today is a promise I keep to myself. And meditation, well, that's learning to be quiet enough so that you can hear your inner intuition. For me, meditation is doing the next right thing. I'd love to sit and play video games all day. I really would. However, I've learned that life actually works better if I open the mail, pay the bills, clean the bathroom, do the dishes. And my relationships, they work better when I hold up my end of life. So meditation is mindfulness, being present, doing the next right thing. I'm volunteering on the WSO Spirituality Literature Subcommittee. And we're looking at how literature is less than welcoming to alternative viewpoints. I'm on the WSO Diversity, Inclusion, and Accessibility Committee. We meet twice a month on the first and third Fridays. We welcome anyone interested in making ACA a more welcoming organization. I'm co-founder of two We Agnostic virtual meetings where we use secular-based 12-step literature to study the steps from a secular perspective. We meet on Thursday and Sunday nights. We're listed under online meetings, and you can search for secular meetings to find other atheist and agnostic-friendly meetings. I'd like to encourage you to think about my journey. The people who shamed me probably didn't know they were shaming me. So every time I couldn't find recovery, it was a hit to my self-esteem and my confidence. Today, I have a solid recovery. I have a foundation built over time. That wasn't true in the beginning. So I'd like to encourage everyone to ask yourself, what could I do better? How could I be more welcoming? Is there something I'm doing or that I'm saying that might not be as encouraging as I'd like? Be courageous. Ask other people, how is my behavior in a meeting? Does my recovery reflect what other adult children would want? And please, if you remember nothing else, remember, it's hard enough to walk into these damn rooms. Please, could we stop shaming people for looking and behaving differently? Thank you.
Thank you for sharing, Julianne. You were heard.